Welcome to Session 8 of the PDH online course on the 2008 National Electric Code. We're going to go into Chapter 5, Hazardous Locations, and skip through it in a little bit of a hurry, but pick up some interesting details while not focusing so heavily on the Class 1, Division 1, Class 1, Division 2 that are well described elsewhere and truly deserve close attention. Chapter 5, Article 500 plus, the early, immediately following the 500 designation, discusses hazardous locations. These deserve close attention beyond the scope of this course. If you're new to designing electric power controls and lighting in hazardous areas, a good point in starting point in the application guides from Krauss, Heinz, and Appleton. And what's beautiful about them is they give very detailed graphics showing which piece goes which place. And it makes so much sense when you look at that. And you look at your design and you do the same thing. I mean, you put the seal right here because it shows the seal here. You put the explosion roof lighting fixture here. You put the general purpose lighting fixture here because in a Division 2 with no arcing, sparking devices, it's acceptable. So we're going to kind of skip it here. The only consistent error I encounter in the field is ignoring the Division 2 buffer between Division 1 and non-hazardous areas. Typically, there should be a 3-foot buffer just where the architects like to put the light switch. It must be an explosion-proof switch, even though it's outside the Division 1 hazardous area, because with the door open, the vapors come out to disperse. And exactly as I said, the only way you can have a sharp demarcation between Division 1 and non-hazardous is if you've got an unpenetrated wall. As soon as there's a penetration, door open, there has to be a Division 2 area. I got into this recently on some people who are new to doing lift stations. Very interesting story. I apologize for taking so much of your time, but you know what we're doing with this ecology-sensitive stuff? There is a device called a living machine. It is a patented function of Worrell water something or other. You can find them on the internet. But what they do is they turn your wastewater treatment plant into a public showplace, and you get all kinds of lead points. I mean, and it's beautiful. I mean, it truly is beautiful. It's a wonderful, wonderful invention. But they've never considered wastewater treatment plants hazardous areas before. Always the people who buy these have been so excited about it that they didn't look at the fact that it's wastewater treatment with methane present. So they're shown as non-hazardous. Well, our inspector's a little better than their inspectors. He said, looks like a sewer treatment plant to me. First tank looks like a wet well. And he insists that we do hazardous area classification with a hazardous area map. They'd never heard of a hazardous area map. Well, the first thing you do whenever you do hazardous area classification is you draw a map where you think the Division 1 is with a certain kind of cross-hatching, where you think the Division 2 is with a different kind of cross-hatching, and where it's non-hazardous with no cross-hatching. And then you kind of circulate this around, make sure everybody agrees on it. You go ahead and do your design. You buy the stuff to match the documents. I think this is 500.4. It's a requirement. It's not a good idea. Well, I would differ with that. It certainly is a good idea. But it's a requirement of the code. And they never heard of anything like this. Okay, never mind. Article 517 discusses details of healthcare facilities. It's grouped under hazardous locations because of explosive anesthetics and oxygen. Oxygen can cause very intense fires because anything else will burn in oxygen. There is a wide range of special healthcare requirements in the National Electric Code and in IEEE publications, I believe it's the White Book, and in government publications relating to licensing the institutions. And if you ever get involved in one of these jobs, be aware the first thing you do is find the licensing requirement, because at the end of the day, there is an agency that comes through and says, yeah, this is a hospital, here's your sticker, now you can have patients come in. No sticker, no hospital. So it has to be designed to their standards, which are available, but you have to go out and get them. Also, your author has no experience in these areas to share. I have bad experience, which I don't want to share, except maybe learn from my mistakes. Article 518, assembly occupancies. Now, you're going to find something a little bit vague in this discussion, and that's because the answer changes in different locations and under different circumstances. But let's try and get some general principles. Article 518 relates to assembly occupancies. For the most part, this means spaces intended for 50 persons or more per the International Building Code, but 100 per the 2000 National Electric Code, and in some cases 30 or more persons. And that's the ambiguity. Is it an assembly occupancy because it has 100 persons, 50 persons, or 30 persons? And this is the kind of thing that your architect is especially trained to define, and you write it down after he tells you. And if they change their mind later, they pay for it. It becomes a change of scope. The National Electric Code Handbook includes a table to convert room square feet to expected occupancy. For concentrated use without fixed seating, the number is 7 square feet per person. A typical classroom is 900 square feet. Without furniture, this computes as 900 divided by 7, or 129 persons. Thus, an empty classroom in the basement that is kept empty as a tornado shelter is a place of assembly for the Building Code and National Electric Code. This invokes special exit requirements that usually aren't met by classrooms. Now, again, I went out of my way to find the worst possible circumstance, but yeah, parts of the country don't have tornadoes, so they don't worry about tornado shelters. But in this day of terrorism and other natural disasters and, heaven forbid, toxic releases, the school better have a plan for what they're going to do, and they better have a place of assembly. And if it's 7 square feet per person, it doesn't take a very large space to become a place of assembly under the National Electric Code and the International Building Code. A quirk of both the Building Code and National Electric Code regards stages. If a permanent stage is present, the space automatically is deemed a place of assembly, and NEC 520 applies. If portable risers are used, it may still be a place of assembly, but special fire rules for theaters and NEC 520 do not apply. Conference centers are a special problem because individual vendor booths usually want power and temporary flexible cords that can bring trip hazards well beyond the fire hazards. The NEC responds to this with in-floor heavy-duty receptacles, temporary power distributions, which may be 483, 208, 120 out, a treadle, which is a hard rubber ramp over floor flexible cable, and that's illustrated in the National Electric Code Handbook. These temporary power distribution methods are so appropriate for other outdoor, like for instance river walks and multi-view park places, and they're being installed in many urban areas. Did I zoom past that too fast to give you a chance to form a picture on? These things look like vaults. I mean, they're heavy steel boxes, sometimes as big as 18 inches by 18 inches. They have a top that flips up with one end hinged with notches cut out of it. And down inside there are receptacles. Now, you buy whatever you want. You want 120 receptacles, you put a bunch of 120 receptacles in there. You want a three-phase 480 receptacle, you put a welding receptacle in there. All we're talking about is an in-floor heavy-duty box that you can drive lift trucks over. And when you close the door, the flexible cable comes through it. Now, let's say we decided on the 483 because you get an awful lot of power through a 483 flexible cable. Then you put a power distribution unit next to it. What is that? Looks for all the world like a Square D mini power zone, and other people make different brands of these. Also, other people make complete units. They assemble all the parts in the 120 volt receptacles. So, a real tidy way to answer the problem, and I'm so proud that the National Electric Code is solving problems here. And then, again, if you go through conference centers or craft shows, always cables all over the floor. That is legal if they protect them. And this treadle, which they show in the NEC handbook, is again just a fabulous solution to the problem. It's heavy enough, it doesn't flip out of the way if somebody kicks it. It's heavy enough, you can drive a lift truck over it. I mean, once again, this is heavy duty industrial grade stuff where people are wandering around. So it's a little different concept, but it, in my mind, it's a wonderful thing for the National Electric Code to be solving problems this way. Non-metallic raceways, conduit, and surface raceway are forbidden in places of assembly. Again, I say non-metallic. Most computer classroom upgrades may be non-conforming. One major manufacturer of combined surface raceway for both power and data does not sell a metallic product. All they have is non-metallic, and this is not appropriate for large computer labs. This course is not addressing theaters, carnivals, amusement parks, manufactured buildings, projection rooms, TV or motion picture studios, agricultural buildings, mobile homes, floating buildings, marinas, or temporary installations. Each is addressed in some detail with special requirements in the 2008 National Electric Code. Chapter 6 is special machinery. And again, we're not going to cover that in this course. The sections include electric signs, modular office furnishings, cranes and hoists, elevators, electric vehicle charging, electrified truck parking places, electric welders, audio signal processing, information technology equipment, electronics, induction heating, electrolytic cells, electroplating, industrial machines, irrigation, swimming pools and fountains, photovoltaics, fuel cells, and fire pumps. Note that several of these are emerging technologies being installed and sold by market-oriented firms rather than technology firms with a deep safety ethic. Both photovoltaics and fuel cells involve extremely high DC currents, and disconnect switches, protective devices, and raceways for conductors have been overlooked in many installations. The National Electric Code does apply, and your author's interpretation is that a building permit, plans review, and electrical inspection should be associated with each. The next section is Chapter 7, Special Conditions. I'd like to come back to that after a break. So if you're in a real hurry, start the next session of the recordings. And if not, take a break with me or even come back tomorrow.